First of all, I got to say, in case I didn't geek out enough about it earlier, I freaking love this cover. I don't know why. I'm just a fanatic for nice covers, and this thing is tight.
Yeah, Ron Earl Phillips, who's the publisher of Shotgun Honey, does the cover designs, and he's a genius. If you look at other ones that he's done over the past decade or so, I think a few of them have even been nominated for design awards, but generally, he does an amazing job. He's got a great aesthetic and a visual sense.
Wait a minute. You're telling me that Ron is Bad Fido?
Yes. The secret is out.
Because, you know, and I think that's cool. Everybody, you know, you got to have a catchy name to be able to do your thing. And then, you know, maybe you want to keep autonomy because, and you said his title at Shotgun Honey was what again?
He's the publisher of Shotgun Honey, but he also does the design for the covers.
Got it. So this is his baby. Mm-hmm. Okay. We're going to talk about Shotgun Honey because I have had a number of people sent my way from Shotgun Honey. And I want to think, who did it start with? JB Stevens, maybe?
Yeah, probably. That sounds about right.
He got all up in my grill and we're like, yeah, come on. And he was the first one to approach me and he's the last one that's going to be on the calendar. I don't quite understand that. Maybe he's just that busy. Mm-hmm.
No, he's usually juggling a lot of balls. He's actually, from a kind of a business of writing standpoint, JB's actually really amazing. He has all these systems worked out for like newsletter uptake and subscribers and everything else. Like he's a real, it'll be an interesting conversation with him when you have it, just because he is an entire fount of knowledge about the publishing process and everything else. I've really liked interacting with him.
And he is self-published or traditional?
He is traditionally published through Shotgun Honey. His next book, which I believe is A Therapeutic Death, is coming out relatively soon, I think. And he has a number of short stories to his credit in various magazines. I don't believe he's gone the self-publishing route.
Okay, so this is my ignorance. I'm going to admit it here first time on my show because I'm not, I'm not always the sharpest knife in the drawer, Nick. Well,
neither me.
And that is that I thought Shotgun Honey originally, I'm going to get some beef on this, I'm sure, was a independent label. I'm David. I go out and start a label called David's Books. Mm-hmm. And then I go, hey, Nick, want to be part of David's Books? And you go, sure. I don't know anything about how the system works. So count me in. And then I put your book out and I'll drop the dime on kind of promoting it for you and so forth. But you'll help along. But it's still, you know, I'm going to take care of the printing and all that stuff. So I'm a self-published guy helping another self-published guy. But Shotgun's actually super legit.
Yeah, it's super legit. I mean, they've been nominated for and won various awards. I mean, there's a whole infrastructure in terms of the editorial process and so on. In addition to the books, there's also the Shotgun Honey website, which runs crime fiction, I think at a cadence of once a week. And that has an entire editorial board called The Gauntlet, which, you know, obviously evaluates and edits and so on all the content that gets published through that. So yeah, no, it's a real concern. It's a small unit, but it's a highly effective one.
Okay. So if I have appeared ignorant on the show, I'm totally cool with that because I can be ignorant, but now I know for sure I'm dialed in.
Good.
And Nick, you'll have to forgive Dexter in the background.
No, that's fine. Hi, Dexter.
Yeah. He says hi. He had day camp yesterday, and I said, you can't have it 2 days in a row, son, because you're going to break daddy's bank. So he's home with me today.
Oh.
All right, so let's talk about Lovin' Bullets, which is this mega bomb edition. Mm-hmm. I'm going to talk about that phrase in just a second, but they're kind of calling it a 21st century Bonnie and Clyde featuring a wisecracking duo who blast their way from Brooklyn to Cuba and back without trying to get killed and meeting some super seedy characters along the way. And Nick, I loved it, man. It was about as fast as I could go trying to keep up with it. And I have several questions, very specific, and many, many comments. So thank you for joining the show today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Sean Cosby, S.A. Cosby, calls it visceral and vivacious. Mm. That, in my world, equals BAM! Publishers Weekly says it's for diehard Kolakowski fans. Now, Nick, do me a favor and describe to me in the best way you can, what is a Kolakowski fan? And I consider myself now one of those.
Let's see. How would I describe the fan? I mean, people who are big fans of combining, I guess, kind of rambunctious violence with comedy with a certain sense of pathos at the same time. I think would sort of be the stereotypical fan if I were to try to imagine such a creature. There is a lot of rambunctious crime fiction out there, and I'm an avid consumer of it, and I love it. I try to kind of give a sort of undercurrent of darkness to everything, just because, I mean, you know, violence can be entertaining, and, you know, there is a heavy comedic element to it, but ultimately, I mean, it's fictional characters' lives, but it's still sort of lives in play. So I try to balance out kind of the humor and everything else with enough, I guess, you know, not morbidity, but something to kind of give it a little bit more weight to it. And I guess the fans are the people who find that kind of duality appealing.
There is a moment, I won't do it justice, but there was a moment where this main character is in a situation that he's been chased by this guy, and the guy has been hurt in a wreck, and they've been shot at, and the guy's laying there on the grass, and he's looking up at the good guy, the main guy, and says, "You gonna shoot me or what?" This goes on for quite some time, and the guy's having this existential moment of like, "Well, what is death and what is life and love? Isn't that an electrical energy exchange or something like this?" And it's going on, and it's pontificating, and it's hilarious, and you can just see this guy sweating bullets, and he's bleeding, and he's got glass in his face, and he's like, "Come on, the waiting, it's killing me," and he's like, "No, I don't know, maybe I should just let it go." And I think his phone rings and he takes a conversation. He goes, "Excuse me just a second." And he takes the call, la, 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 la. And then he turns around and just goes.
That character, the assassin character who you're referring to, is, yes. It's funny because sometimes with narrative voice and writing in general, you obviously sometimes it's a struggle and, you know, you go through multiple drafts and you don't quite get it right and so on. That is the one character voice in any of my books or short stories, it just kind of flows out. There's just something about that personality that, for better or worse, I sort of really sync with. So yeah, all of those scenes, like just it almost like automatic writing. I mean, that stuff just came out. That character is my favorite aspect of the book.
It is the best part of the book. And for some reason, I have a very tight affinity for wisecracking, murderous scandals who just want to wreak mayhem along the way and yet find the comedic lift in every moment. But now the other part of that question is, and I think I've got it, but I want to be crystal clear to my readers, and we're going to circle back around later because I want to reference it once again. But what makes this a mega bomb edition?
Good question. So Love and Bullets was originally published as three novellas from 2017 through 2019. There was A Brutal Bunch of Heartbroken Saps, followed by Slaughterhouse Blues, followed by Main Bad Guy. And originally that was, you know, the three short novellas, and that was sort of going to be it for it. And then in 2019, we were approached by Surkamp Verlag, which is a big German publisher that wanted to release kind of a combined edition of the books. And so it gave me the opportunity to take all three novellas and rewrite them and, you know, kind of create a more cohesive single larger novel out of it. It was published in Germany in 2020. It actually became like it did really well over there. To the point where there was a German TV program that like did a skit on it where, like, for example, they dress someone up as Elvis, and like they did a kidnapping scene. So I mean it did really well, which gave Shotgun Honey the idea of also releasing kind of the giant combined mega bomb edition. And the privilege that I had, and a lot of writers don't get this chance, is now I could tinker with it yet again, which is amazing. You know, and any writer will tell you, like, the ability to kind of just go through and relentlessly fix it is an opportunity you don't pass up on. So I added another probably about 25% to the book on top of that. So that's what made it the mega bomb. I mean, originally it was a pretty thick book to begin with. And then I got the chance to like, okay, I'm going to build all this connective tissue, rejigger the ending a little bit, and basically create a doorstop. So
okay, so that's what written and remastered means.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And also, yeah, and I jumped ahead of myself because I was going to sit here. There are other titles of books that you've written, and you jumped me a little bit there, but it's like Brutal Bunch of Heartbroken Saps, Slaughterhouse Blues, Main Bad Guy, mm-hmm. Boise Long Pig Hunting Club, mm-hmm. Rattlesnake Rodeo, Maxine Unleashes Doomsday, an absolute unit. Mm-hmm. And as I was reading this book, which is broken to three specific parts with really cool titles, and as I'm reading the titles, I'm like, geez, Nick should have made these standalone books. And it wasn't until I was done that I'm like, hey, Dork, wake up. That's what he did.
Yeah. I mean, it was, I mean, I loved all those titles. A Brutal Bunch of Heartbroken Saps, the origin of that title. When I wrote the first novella, I struggled to come up with any sort of title. And then, a mutual friend of my wife's and I, wrote a long essay in, there's a section in the New York Times where people talk about like their failed romances or how, you know, they found their life partner or whatever. And it was this long essay about how heartbreak and so on. And my wife, who was brushing her teeth as I was kind of reading excerpts from this article out loud, suddenly shouted, "All of you writers are just a brutal bunch of heartbroken saps." Because our friend had, like, you know, kind of poured out their entire relationship in print and, like, completely decimated their ex-partner and everything like that. So, and I was like, yes, that's it. That's the title. Like, I'm not going to go with something generic. It's got to be that. And then, yeah, Slaughterhouse Blues and Main Bad Guy were just titles I've been wanting to use for years. You know, you hear these phrases in the air and you write them down. You're like, oh, that'd make a good title sure. Someday. And then, bam, put them in.
So, wife is G.
Yes. Yeah, Gina.
To which the book is dedicated. Yeah. Uh-huh. How cool is that? And I love the fact that synchronicity, spontaneity, when that happens, that's one of my highlights in life. And my wife and I have that same kind of synergistic relationship. She'll make a comment. Matter of fact, one day she made a comment, side note, we'd come in from running a half marathon or something. Mm-hmm. And as we tend to do, we come in the garage and we close the garage and we rip all our clothes off and throw it in the wash before we come into the mm-hmm. house. And I said, well, how you doing? I'm like, this should be a podcast. She goes, yeah, we'll just call it Naked Monday.
Nice.
And that became the title of my podcast for almost a year until I went, no one quite ever got what Naked Monday was about.
That's a great title. I mean, that would apply to so many different things. It's just, yeah, just there's a synergy. Yeah. There's a crackle to it. It's great.
Okay, good. I'll keep it then. Okay, yet I digress. This show is about you. Now, I do want to talk about this because I love New York. Mm-hmm. I know it sounds like a bumper sticker, but how much do you think, and what part of town do you live in? Just give me a ballpark.
We're in Long Island City, which is former industrial neighborhood, now the fastest growing neighborhood in America or something crazy. It's right on the East River. I mean, if there wasn't an East River in the way, we would be Midtown.
Got it. Okay. How do you think living in New York City helps your writing?
It helps because, I mean, there's sort of endless material that comes, you know, you just simply by walking down the street, you see enough oddities, you know, and people complain that, all the roughness and all the weird edges have been gradually sanded out of New York over the past however many years. I don't think that's necessarily true. I mean, you might need to be walking, you know, on the Lower East Side at 2 a.m. or whatever, but you will find like these interesting patterns and weirdnesses and you'll overhear phrases and so on. I generally walk around, or I used to walk around with a paper notebook. Now I just use my iPhone's note thing. And whenever I see something or hear something or whatever that's just interesting, I'll pluck it. And then from that sort of mosaic document, I mean, a lot of that just sort of gets seeded into stories. So, I mean, that's sort of the most vital element that I think the city lends to things. The other thing, too, is that there's a great community of writers here, which, I mean, before I lived in New York, I lived in D.C. And D.C. had a kind of a small writing community, but nothing like New York does. New York has, well, I guess a number of cities around the country have this, but there are regular noirs at the bar here where crime fiction writers gather and read their latest works and network, for want of a better term, and so on. You know, and once you sort of build that community, it improves your writing because you start sharing drafts around and stuff like that. So that part of it's also really vital. You know, and with the pandemic, The interesting thing about the pandemic is a lot of that moved online. I mean, now there's Twitter, there's Discord servers. And so like we've managed to sort of replicate a community online, but it's not quite the same as being able to kind of tuck into a bar with like 25 other crime fiction writers and spend the night, you know, going through stuff.
Yeah. There is a noir at the bar in Los Angeles, isn't there?
There is. A number of cities have them. People spring them up. I mean, there's been a couple in Jersey. There's been a couple in the D.C. area in the last couple of years. BoucherCon, the big crime fiction conference, a lot of people go to that. And then there's a noir at the bar there. And I think people get the idea from there, for example. And then they go and they start them up in Milwaukee and Chicago and points north, south, east, and west.
Awesome. Well, I'm in San Diego, 90 minutes south of L.A., and I'm just going to have to jump in the car and drive up for Noir at the Bar in L.A. because San Diego is cool and hip and laid back and groovy and all that, but it is not necessarily a raging bastion of uber creativity. I'll probably get shit for that, but, you know, it could use a little kick in the pants, I suppose. Maybe I'll just have to start it myself, huh?
Yeah, you could. I mean, I mean, I think that's what people do. I think they like, you know, they want to start something. So they post it up on Facebook and I don't know, staple a flyer to the supermarket wall or whatever. But there's some really good, interesting, fascinating writers around San Diego. I mean, there's Brian Asman who wrote Nunchuck City and a couple of other books that do really well. He's kind of like in the bizarro crime horror genre. I mean, yeah, more of them will come to mind. I mean, we're everywhere. We're like, I mean, it's a whole secret society of writers.
We are everywhere.
Indeed. Yeah.
Brian Asman, is that what you said?
Asman. Yeah. No, he's really good. I think he lives in San Diego. There's a couple of other folks as well. But yeah, no, if you put the feelers out there, they will come. I mean, they will, they'll drive many hours.
Okay, well then I will take my foot out of my mouth and insert it up my butt and do something about that. Reason I asked that about New York is, and I think I shared this with somebody recently, when I lived in Manhattan, I lived there in 95 and then again in 2016, and there is something magical. I can't describe it, but here's the best I can do. There's something about, I would come home from my radio show back in 95 and, you know, you're on the bubble from 5 a.m. till 10 and you're just, you know, cranking out music and interviewing people. So I would walk home from down in Greenwich Village up to the Upper West Side and just to decompress. And then I'd go home, open a window, and I would just let the sounds of the city wash over me and I would crank out just bam, 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 bam. And I don't know what it is, man, but there's some kind of electricity there that makes it happen.
It's absolutely there. And I mean, it's the side consequence of having 10 million people squeezed into a really, really tiny space. No, it's just, I mean, you know, just the sort of a natural friction. I mean, there's actual electricity in the air. It's, yeah, no, it's an amazing place. Even when there's nobody on the streets, you still kind of, you know, and it's really late at night, you can still feel it like kind of in the air, like this crackle of proximity almost that you're on this little set of islands with all these souls.
Okay, you've given me an idea for two different titles, Crackle of Electricity and Rambunctious Violence in Comedy.
Yeah, use them.
All right, so back to Love and Bullets. This book has it all, folks. It's got action, it's got romance, it's got guns, it's got a wicked tough wisecracking broad and a ball-busting dude, plus enough violence and revenge to satisfy everyone, including the family. Gather around, won't you?
Read a J for more.
Yeah, exactly. You know, a lot of people would say, some people would say, when referring to pulp, that, oh, you write that. But, you know, I'm looking at some of your creds and, you know, Washington Post, North American Review, your stories have appeared some pretty handsome places, which doesn't just happen and is not the easiest thing in the world to do. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would. I mean, my day job is as a journalist. And so, I'm never not writing. And, you know, I've spent, when I was younger, this actually in a fit of true insanity. I mean, I had a resolution in my 20s where I would pitch one story to one place every day and so on. And so inevitably, I mean, just by sheer law of averages, eventually you're going to plunk into a very broad range of publications for a very broad range of fiction and nonfiction if you do that. So that, that sort of explains my spread. I think I forget which writer, but some writer has a bio, which it still sticks in my mind to this day, or something to the effect of has appeared only once in a suspiciously high number of publications. I think a lot of writers like fall in that category where if you're an aggressive pitcher and like you're a really prolific writer, like eventually you'll appear in most places at least once.
Well, good. This begins to answer a question that I've got. I would love to know because I don't know how to do this. Let's say, for instance, and I'll use Washington Post. I'm sure your proximity at the time probably helps that. And I'm glad you answered my next question, which was, what is your daytime job? So as a journalist, I know that that helps. Could somebody like me, is it that I need to have written a vast number of articles or shorts or novellas or fill in the blank in order to then be received? Or is it my ability to pitch and, pitch to the right person?
So with that's, I mean, that is the question. The Washington Post was kind of a unique circumstance because what I did the one thing they tell you to never, ever, ever do as a writer, which is write pieces on spec and send them. And I mean, it's good advice because, you know, obviously, you know, you do all this research, you commit all of this time. And then if the pitch is, if the article is rejected after you spend all this time writing it, I mean, that's time and money down the drain. But, In the case of the Post, what happened was my entry, this was, this would have been 2005, 2006, but Darren Aronofsky, the director of Requiem for a Dream, Pi, The Fountain, a bunch of other highly disturbing art house movies that I love deeply, he came to DC to launch The Fountain. And I read that he was in town. I had always wanted to write for the Washington Post. And so I basically conned my way into an interview with him. I showed up. I'm a little bit blurry on what exactly I said to get past the gatekeepers, but I ended up having dinner with him and a bunch of other journalists from a bunch of other publications. Thankfully, there was nobody from the Washington Post who was already there, because otherwise that would have become a hilarious comedy of errors very quickly. But I got the interview. I wrote it up that night. Like, I basically rushed home and typed it and sent it to their weekend section. And then once that happened, and once they accepted and paid me for it, et cetera, the editors there decided, like, oh, here's this lunatic who'll do anything on short notice. And so they started sending me, you know, I interviewed Craig Ferguson. I interviewed Lawrence Wright, just a bunch of other people. And they sort of, once you're known sort of player, then, you know, they tend to use you over and over again, because, you know, one thing, and I can say this as a occasional magazine editor, one thing that editors really like is having kind of a reliable person that you can just call up and be like, do this, and they'll do it. But yeah, I mean, it's writing the article in advance and like kind of doing all of your legwork and committing, that is generally what they don't recommend doing. But perversely enough, it's always worked for me. And that's how I've got my foot in the door in a lot of places. But yeah, I'm not sure I'm necessarily the best example to follow.
Okay, I'll take it, though. And I also think that, you know, courage and boldness is rewarded if you're not an asshole, you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I definitely agree with that. Yeah.
Plus, a maxim in Hollywood is that people like to work with people that they like. And it seems ridiculously simple-minded, but it's true. I mean, think about it. You want to work with somebody that, you know what, I like that Nick guy. He's a fun guy. He's on time. He shows up. He makes me laugh. I mean, it's a win-win.
Definitely. I mean, the people in terms of like the crime fiction world, I mean, the people who I've known who have achieved like the most success, like kind of the big book deals and kind of networked effectively and everything, that have always been the nicest people. I mean, whereas people who tend to be, you know, kind of a little bit sociopathic or whatever, like sometimes they might, you know, score one good book deal or, you know, make kind of a crucial connection or whatever, but they never last very long. It's always the nice people who seem to kind of have sustained careers because, as you said, everyone wants to work with them. It's just, it's good policy.
Yeah. from my shiny object apartment with a question out of nowhere. What is the, only because I like the way your mind works, and I'm riveted by this story, which I know that I'm going to go back and read other ones. What is the weirdest gig job you've ever had?
So when I graduated college, in 2003. So it wasn't like a 2009 economy, but the economy was still a little bit down. And through a chain of hilarious circumstances, I actually ended up working as a subcontractor for the State Department's Bureau of North Africa and the Middle East. And what we were tasked with doing, and the contractor I was working for, which was a publishing company in DC, we were tasked with creating a glossy sort of Esquire or GQ style magazine in Arabic that was kind of imagine like, you know, kind of like obviously, you know, a magazine like GQ, but without any nudity or sex or profanity, sure, or anything like that, completely sanitized, but, you know, still with the same celebrity interviews and fashion tips and everything like that. So we produced these magazines, which the magazine was called High. And we did that for about a year and a half. Full, beautiful production team, like really skilled New York journalists working on it. We had somebody who was our celebrity interviewer, like lots of money. When we produced each issue, it was then printed in Manila at a government facility, loaded onto C-130s, flown into the Middle East, where it was handed out in Baghdad, you know, Cairo, all kind of, you know, throughout Jordan, all the major spots. And then that was supposed to win hearts and minds. And it was one of those circumstances where you're kind of like, all right, I mean, somebody thought this was a good idea and we're rolling with it because it's interesting to work on. But this is like, it was almost like Dr. Strangelove in a certain sense, like just like this completely weird thing. I wrote about it for Fast Company several years later. It was just kind of like, you know, public diplomacy is good. And, you know, you obviously, you know, if you take it at its sort of surface value, you know, kind of extending like this, trying to explain American culture is potentially a good thing, but it just, nobody was ever quite sure what was going on. In the meantime, we were burning a lot of money. At one point, we accidentally included an image of a woman with bare shoulders, and in Saudi Arabia, they actually burned it on the runway. The Committee for the Promotion of Virtue and Suppression of Vice, like, poured gasoline over a giant pallet of it and lit it on fire. We're watching this on video in, like, the bowels of the State Department, like, and you just can't believe, like, this is your life. So I would say that's probably the weirdest, probably the, easily the weirdest job I ever had. Off the top of my head. I mean, there's been all sorts of weirdo. When you're a professional writer, you end up doing all sorts of weirdo stuff. Yeah. But yeah, that probably takes the cake.
Okay, two things. I can't top that. Number one, I have to branch that off one more step because you're such a great storyteller. Who is one of the wackiest characters you grew up with? It could be when you were a kid, you were in college, it could be, but just somebody who was like, that guy's just like a half a bubble off plum, you know?
Oh, yeah.
It's a Carpenter reference.
So the weirdest, oh man. I mean, the thing is that inevitably these people all end up actually in the books in kind of one form or another, like not necessarily taken whole cloth and transplanted to the book, but sort of elements of their DNA, it ends up informing the characters.
That's exactly where I'm headed.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, Bill in Love and Bullets is based very heavily on a gentleman who I worked with for a number of years who sort of was – he kind of engaged. I mean, saying that very sort of luxury-obsessed, you know, kind of always – not, he wasn't an outright con man, but he was certainly somebody who, you know, like if there was any sort of hustle to be hustled, he would be the one hustling it as fast as humanly possible. I mean, like, so working with him was a really bizarre trip, and we had some weird adventures together in terms of, like, the storytelling. So this guy and I, we used to run a cigar magazine together. This is another one of those kind of weird jobs where, you know, you kind of – end up doing things for reasons completely outside of your control. But we were in the Bahamas, And we had been partying the night before with a bunch of people. We had just been to Cuba. We had just done this huge, ferociously difficult assignment in Cuba, gotten out. We were in the Bahamas and we were going to fly the next day back to the States. So I'm not really a huge drinker, and I kind of went to bed relatively early because I was just bushed. It was like we had done five countries in however many days, you know, and, you know, the photographer, the other writer, everyone went to bed. And then my friend was in the room next to me, and there was a connecting door between the two rooms. He had way too much to drink and who knows whatever else he was consuming. But the previous occupant of his room had set the clock radio for some absurdly hour, like 6:30 AM or whatever. So the radio clicks on at 6:30. He is like still sort of completely addled out of his mind when this loud church music, because it was a Sunday, starts blasting from the radio. He's not sure what's going on. He's still like kind of out of his mind, but he thinks for some reason that it's coming from my room. So he blearily stumbles out of bed, goes to the connecting door, and starts ramming it with his fist while screaming, "Turn down that church music," because he didn't realize it was coming from the radio in his own room. I snap away because someone's pounding on the door. I think we're still in Cuba, and it's, you know, La Policia is trying to kick down the door. So I bolt out of bed, and this was back when, you know, I would keep my jeans right by my bed, you know, just in case I had to make a hasty exit from something. The window is open because it's the Bahamas and it's warm. I'm throwing on my jeans. I'm still like only maybe 10% awake. I'm stumbling across the room as fast as I can because I'm like on instinct going to go out the window and like just try to like kind of clear the zone before like whatever is on the other side of that door blasts their way through it. And I literally have both of my legs out the window when I see a cruise ship. I'm like, oh no, like this is all wrong. I sort of like, you know, my instincts are no longer controlling me like a puppet. And then I went back inside. I started yelling at him through the door to go back to bed. But I mean, people like that, you know, who you grew up with or who you work with. Yeah. I mean, you know this. I mean, with writers,
sure,
you end up using it all. So that guy ended up,
oh, yeah,
in a big way is Bill.
All right. Well, yeah, Bill was my fave, and I completely get that now. And, you know, we all do that. We take those, we take little bits and pieces of the psychopaths that we hung out with, or the partiers, or the guys, the cool guys. Like, I was never particularly athletic, so I always wanted to be, you know, cool with the athletes. But I realized early on the only way I could be cool with them was to make the girls laugh. So that's how I worked my way in.
That's a good strategy.
Because I could. Yeah, it worked well because I couldn't. Yeah, I'm like, okay, if I can't dribble a ball and chew gum at the same time, and I've got really bad acne, and I can at least make them laugh. And you know, when the acne cleared up, I was in.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, like that's like make them laugh. That's like the key strategy. It'll get you into any place. It'll get you hopefully out of any place. I mean, yeah, no, it's pretty. That was definitely the right tactic for you to pursue.
Yeah. All right. Before we take a quick break, I have one more question here because I want to know, and I feel like I've known you for so long. This is so funny. But tell me what's the ultimate, if, and I'm going to put this in quotes, the ultimate dream come true for Nick Kolakowski. Like, for instance, it could be in the next 5 years, 10 years, 15. You could pick one of those segments. But like, what's that thing that you're achieving for, you're reaching for that you hope to achieve?
I've taken a couple of aborted runs at this in the last several years. I want to write like the big doorstop historical thriller book, like set in like the 19th century, like kind of like what Neal Stephenson did with the Baroque cycle, where you just have like, you know, one of those big lists where it clearly took the author like years to research and years to write. And it's sort of out there and it's kind of like a definitive statement. And like I said, you know that like most, with the exception of Love and Bullets as a combined edition, most of my books tend to be very short. So I just, my goal, my dream is to like actually write something that's like suitably massive. You can kill a Bronx cockroach with it. Like, you know, like we're talking like serious weight. So that's definitely kind of one of my longer term goals.
Like 500 to 600 pages at least.
Yeah. Yeah. Like one of those things where people are like, oh my God, I can't believe you spent so many years on it. And, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Excellent. And are you working on that now, even in little increments while you're writing these rapid fire kind of books? Or do you say to yourself, okay, when I get to this point, then I'm going to sit down and really hunker down and then carve out this period of 2, 3, 4, whatever years and make it happen?
I've been researching it actively researching it for a long time, but that also becomes its own delaying tactic in a certain way. There's always more research you can do. And so eventually I'm going to have to just be like, okay, I'm going to carve out this time and we're actually going to do it. And it's going to be a heavy lift, but I just have to like kind of mentally reconcile myself with that fact.
Okay. Well, I applaud you and I cheer you on.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to play a quick round of rapid fire questions. I am sure Nick knows about this. So stay with us. And we're back with Nick Kolakowski, and I love this guy's name, author of Love and Bullets, the Megabomb Edition, as well as many other titles you are sure to dig into. I see that they're all, I was spending quite a bit of time, Nick, this morning looking at Amazon. Looks like they carry everything of yours.
They do.
And so go to the author's page there. But time now for rapid fire questions. Super easy, lots of fun, nobody gets hurt.
It's a relief.
Number one, and this is perfect for you living in Long Island City-ish. You and a pal are playing some pool, drinking some beers, mm-hmm. hanging out in a neighborhood bar when a fight looks like it's about to break out. Come to learn that the enormous, mean, and ugly bouncer thinks you started the melee, and so he's coming after you. Suddenly, your pal, just seconds before batshit crazy guy comes over to ask you to dance, your pal tosses you one item for you to fight this character with, and you can choose from any one of these three items and tell me why you chose it. Number one, a number two pencil, the caveat being that it is freshly sharpened and has an eraser.
Oh.
Number two, an old-fashioned bottle opener, the one with that pointy end. Or number three, your pal pulls off his 1970s super wide worn out leather belt complete with tacky brass buckle and hands it to you. Which one would you choose?
Oh, I would definitely go with the belt just because, you know, it's got some reach to it. So, I mean, at the very least, I mean, obviously, when faced with like, you know, a 500 pound, you know, pituitary accident, who's really interested in popping off my head, like, you know, the cap off a Coke bottle, I would have absolutely no chance. I took, you know, some kung fu and martial arts in high school, and you know, the sum total of my experience with that was being really good at punching myself in the face by accident. So I would be dead in like about 3.2 seconds dealing with that guy. However, with a belt, I could swing it wildly, like flail it, you know, spastically around enough to like kind of buy some space as the guy came charging in, and then that would hopefully buy me enough seconds to use my superior speed to sidestep and run out the door as fast as humanly possible. So, I definitely go with the belt.
Awesome. Excellent. Just as I somewhat expected. Number two, you and I are going to meet up in New York in late May mm-hmm. for the 17th edition of Thriller Fest.
Oh.
It's put together by my friend KJ Howe and a bunch of super studded authors and rock star volunteers. And you get to choose two people to join the panel of discussions. Now, they can be living or dead. Who will these two people be and why?
Oh, now that you've introduced the dead element, that's really impressive. I would have to go with Jim Thompson, writer of The Getaway, The Grifters, and other great books, as my dead person to kind of show up. And I say that because at BoucherCon and all these other crime fiction conferences, the surest and easiest way to start like a real verbal brawl is to mention Thompson's name, because you have people who are, and I count myself among them, massive Thompson adherents. They love every word that he wrote, even though some of his words got pretty weird. You know, and they defend him as like sort of arguably the best crime fiction writer out there. And then there are people who hate him. A prominent Canadian critic once referred to him as trash in a room full of probably about 200 BoucherCon attendees. So, I mean, his presence at a panel would basically guarantee that, you know, there'd be at the very least like some super interesting discussion. And then in terms of living people, S.J. Rosen, who's a mystery and thriller writer, she's just got like the best reading voice. She's got this like really wry, sharp, voice, and like she's really good at questions and panels. She's really funny. So she would be my second pick.
Exceptional answer. And by the way, will you be at Thriller Fest, do you think?
Yes, so, I think this year. Yeah. Yeah. Knock on wood. And, awesome. And pending, obviously, the situation, I think. Yes.
COVID bullshit.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. You and I will definitely get together and share a beverage.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Number three on rapid fire questions. There is an afterlife of your imagination's making, and you get to return as any one of these three professions. Which would you choose and why? You can be number one, an unbelievably rich and sexy rock star, in case you aren't already. Number two, a world-renowned scientist who surpasses both Einstein and Leonardo da Vinci in smarts, or a writer who may or may not ever really make a living.
Ooh, that's a real tough one. I would go with the scientist just because, I mean, if you invent something that, you know, that changes the world radically, or people are still relying on like 500 years, like who wouldn't want to invent, like, I don't know, the longer lasting light bulb or something like that, just because, you know, sure. Yeah, like 8 decades from now, people are still, you know, relying on you to try to find their car keys. I mean, like, it's just, yeah, I would go with that. I mean, the rock star element is definitely appealing potentially, but I've never read a biography of a rock star where they weren't sick of it after a relatively short period of time. I mean, like, you know, and I used to interview celebrities. And so one thing I used to ask them is that, you know, is it all that it's cracked up to be? And more than one of them said something to the effect of that they liked the money and the access, but they could deal without the fame. And so I think, you know, if you're the world famous scientist, you walk down the street, most people aren't going to know who you are. I think a rock star, you start to feel like you're trapped in a gilded cage after a while, but I wouldn't not take it. So yeah, but scientists definitely.
Excellent. You know, it's funny. My wife and I went down to, up to Anaheim to see, America perform. We never had seen America. We love America. So we got there and it was amazing. A couple of observations I made. One was I said, you can pick any random America song you want. And I said, can you imagine singing that same song over and over and over and over and over and over again for decades after decades? And she's like, no. And I'm like, and even worse, and I'm not going to mention any names, this guy couldn't hit those notes anymore. Oh. I mean, he couldn't hit them with a golf club. You know, this is just no way. And each time he tried to hit it, you're like, oh. And then I'm thinking, which is worse, having to have sung those that many times or having sung them when you were at the height of your career and you were really jamming it. And now, decades later, you can't even reach those. So,
yeah, that's the thing about it too. I mean, like not only when you're a writer, the benefit is you only got to produce it once. Once it's down on the page, it's down on the page and that's that. But if you're a singer, you have to sing it with enthusiasm. You got to sing it every day for the rest of your life, or, you know, at least a few times a year, as if you had written it that afternoon and you really love it. Even if you're Mick Jagger, the last thing you want to do is sing Satisfaction for like literally the 50,000th time. I mean, it's hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Good point. Well, but as we begin to wrap up, is there, I like to ask guys and gals, especially those who, and I'll ask them from, you know, the super big guys who are New York Times bestselling, they've got 20 or 30 in their queue, or they're just starting out like some of us. What would you, do you have a good rock solid piece of advice that's kind of a no brainer that's always been true to you, and that you know that if you say to someone, you know, take this little piece of advice and just try to master it, what would that be?
I mean, we touched on this earlier. I mean, I think the important thing is just to, you know, be pleasant, you know, be professional. Like, I mean, don't necessarily be a doormat. Don't let yourself be run over, but, you know, being polite and professional and sort of just being a stand-up human being will get you a long way. I mean, you might not necessarily have a good year, or a deal might not come out the way that you expect it to. You know, you do have setbacks, but as long as you sort of maintain kind of, you know, a professional, like a friendly professional veneer, I mean, I found that opens more doors than anything else, you know, and you start making connections, and then, you know, the next thing you know, you're further along than you thought you would be, hopefully.
Yeah. And look at you, you got them all. You got the looks, you got the talent, you got the affability.
You're making me blush.
Well, Nick Olakowski, thank you so much for joining the Thriller Zone. This has been a hoot.
Yeah, this has been fantastic. Thank you for having me on. This has been amazing. I love the whole questions. I never had to consider, like, you know, between equally ineffective pencil and belt, which I would choose if I was confronted with a violent bouncer. So thank you. Now I will never get that out of my head. It might actually end up in my next book.
Yeah. I don't know where I picked this up recently. I almost wanted to say it was your book, but somebody made a comment. A character made a comment. He said, I can kill you 12 ways to Sunday with a ballpoint pen. And I always thought to myself, now that I want to be able to master that ability so that if someone throws me a sharpened number two, I can equally do justice to murder and mayhem.
I think throughout the John Wick movies, they keep talking over and over about how he murders multiple people in a bar with a number with, I think it is a number two pencil, a pincer.
Yep.
In the words of one of the Russian characters. So I think, it's definitely, hopefully they actually show him. No, actually in one of the movies, he does utilize a pencil to wipe someone out. So it's doable. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Your answers were perfect. Well, the book is Love and Bullets Mega Bomb Edition. NickOlakowski.com is the place you can go to learn more. Of course, Twitter, NKolakowski. Instagram is Nick Kolakowski. All of this will be printed below for your viewing and researching pleasure. But once again, Nick, thank you so much.
Thank you. This has been great.